Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned in to my weekly Wellness Update podcast, bringing you the health news you can use. All right, well, we're winding down on Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and that brings us, I believe we have two more studies I just wanted to review with you on this topic. One of them has to do with breast cancer and stress, and particularly this one was done in younger women, ages 25 to 45. And what they established was a clear link between traumatic stress events and breast cancer. And what they found is that if a woman had two or more traumatic events, she had a 62% greater risk for breast cancer, whereas women who were able to be positive and optimistic had 25% less risk. Now, this is interesting because what happens with trauma? You know, we talk a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder, which essentially just means that when you know, even a brain injury, but an emotional trauma, winds up the nervous system. And this, of course, makes a person feel more anxious, more agitated, shorter fuse, just generally kind of a more wound up feeling, like a cat on a hot tin roof. This is reflective of a chronic generation of inflammation at the cellular level, which is going to irritate tissues all over the body and increase risk. It also throws the biological clocks out of alignment, especially if the stress involves sleeplessness or insomnia, or the mind racing too much before bed, throwing it out of rhythm, throwing the clocks out of rhythm. So you throw your biological clocks out of rhythm, you create immune depression and cancer risk. You get too much nerve-related inflammation, and the same thing can happen. So the moral of the story, of course, is to deal with stress as best you can and then recover from it in terms of getting yourself back on track lifestyle-wise, but also with nutrition to help your nerves heal so that you fully recover from any kind of traumatic stress events. And this would be noticeable because you wouldn't be as anxious, you'd be calmer, you'd have more stress tolerance. But it is interesting, the link here between trauma, immune suppression, cancer risk, in this case breast cancer risk. I think it applies to a lot more than that. And taking an inventory on this just simply because it is a factor that is often not really thought about. And some obviously traumas a lot of times are beyond our control in terms of them happening. So when they do, it's kind of like a concussion. You know, I wrote a really good article on concussion recovery, but it's not a lot different than that. You need nutrition to restore brain plasticity and heal the brain so that it can go back to a baseline where it's not conditioned into these memories so that the traumas keep playing like old tapes on a tape player. You know, you start getting stressed about something at work, all of a sudden the feelings of the trauma start coming back. You know, it's that kind of stuff that is the telling little symptoms that this could be a problem for someone. And it's something to keep in mind, it's something to address, not just from the perspective of mental well-being, but also from the perspective of cancer risk reduction. All right. And last but not least, we have here sluggish thyroid associated with breast cancer risk. This study is kind of interesting because it shows that an overactive thyroid is actually protective. Not that you'd really want that, but it's protective in that it generates free radicals that kill the cancer. I mean, to me, that's kind of fascinating that then if our metabolism was going too slow, meaning that it was just too sluggish, that not much would be happening in terms of free radical production. You know, when you make energy, you make some free radicals. That's just the way it is. And so it could very well be, at least this study is suggesting, that a normal amount of free radical production is probably healthy. It's kind of like a form of stress that actually has some beneficial effects. There's absolutely no way you could stop every free radical simply by taking antioxidants, even if you took them till you were blue in the face. And in reality, the antioxidants that you take as supplements, they support, they're like tools or raw materials for your antioxidant enzyme systems in your body that are turned on and off by various processes. One of the processes that turns on your antioxidant enzymes is, of course, the production of energy. Whereas you make energy, you make heat, and you also make some free radicals, which are naturally deactivated. But it does appear that the free radicals produced during energy production have various signaling functions in the human body that actually help health. So it's not that this is all a bad thing. And this study would indicate that a certain amount of that is good for knocking out mutant cells, although I find that kind of interesting. I don't think actually that we will try to make somebody hyperthyroid for cancer prevention. I think we'll stick with, you know, in boosting up the selenium intake and the iodine intake so as to help the immune system function better and the thyroid function better. I think that will be protective in and of itself. The selenoproteins, one of which is needed to activate thyroid hormone, is also the key. There's other of the selenoproteins that activate the immune system and really help with the cancer issue. So selenium is a key there, I think. But anyway, it's nevertheless linked to breast cancer risk, which I find interesting. Well, there was a pretty widely publicized study out about a week or so ago that showed that a multiple vitamin reduced the total cancer risk in men. It got a lot of press, interestingly, because it was published by the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the study involved middle-aged and older doctors, 14,641 of them, that took a daily supplement for 11 years. So this was actually double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized, gold-standard study, the kind that are almost never done because they're A, expensive, and B, it's hard to do. So the fact that it showed a reduced risk of cancer, modest but nevertheless good enough, led the researchers, which were from Johns Hopkins University, to say that the data supported the potential use of multiple vitamin supplements in the prevention of cancer in middle-aged and older men. Well, that is pretty stunning for America, mainstream people, and this journal to have anything nice to say about vitamins, much less actually acknowledge the fact that they could help reduce cancer risk. Now, of course, B vitamins are involved with the function of your genes and the stability of your DNA, and even the repair of your DNA, as are some basic antioxidants and trace minerals that would typically be in a multiple vitamin. So it's not surprising that this could happen. It is pretty encouraging that it did happen. And just a reminder that for both men and women, a multiple vitamin a day or two, and more if your energy level needs extra support, is a very basic way to fortify your diet, which is typically lacking in the B vitamins. And some of the, you know, of course, our soils are lacking in some of the minerals, so they don't even get into the food. And then, of course, the processing processes them out a lot of times. So, a multiple vitamin and multiple antioxidant. I mean, these are just basic things that are good for your health and are a really good idea for anybody at any age. All right. DHA boosts memory in young adults. These were adults ages 18 to 25 who took 750 milligrams of DHA per day for 6 months and had significant improvement in memory. They were tested at the beginning of the study. And interestingly, the ones at the beginning of the study who had the lowest blood levels of DHA based on their dietary intake before they started taking fish oil supplements, also had the best memory, whoever just happened to have the best DHA levels. This is young people. And then when they increased the DHA intake of all of them, the ones with the highest blood levels had the best memory scores. Significant improvements. This astounded the researchers, by the way, because when you take young people, young people have a lot of vitality of energetic function, should have a lot of vitality of brain function. I know that's not the case in situations these days because we have, you know, so much junk food consumption that it even poisons the genetic advantage of being young. But nevertheless, a young person should be on top of their game if they're eating well and exercising and sleeping and generally managing their life okay. They should have, you know, much better cognitive function than somebody 40 or 50 or 60 years older. As a general rule, that's, quicker reflexes, quicker nerve connections, faster brain speed, and more flexible brain structure for learning better. These are advantages of youth. And so the researchers were astounded because they could enhance the working memory performance even further, despite the young people being really at the top of their performance capability from an aging perspective. So, this is a reason for everyone to take DHA. I think, 250 to 500 milligrams is a good dose for just general health for anybody, really, at any age. But this was 750 milligrams a day, which is, starting to enter into the therapeutic level of DHA, which is a good thing to test it at this kind of dose. You're more likely to see improvements. But we're talking about improvement of human ability here. We're not just talking about, people with bad memory or brain fog or, attention deficit issues. We're just talking about generally better cognitive function in people who aren't even complaining about function. And so we're seeing improvement in human ability, i.e. human intelligence, meaning human performance could potentially be better, skills could be better, and of course that translates into many things, problem solving being better in one's life, that kind of stuff. So I mean, there's a lot of benefit here, and we can see it in young people in this study. Of course, it applies also to pregnant mothers, to infants, to young children, to middle-aged adults, to older adults. All have benefited from DHA. And the dose here, 750 milligrams, I think the higher-end therapeutic dose of DHA would be around 2,000 milligrams a day of DHA, not a fish oil, mind you. DHA is, anywhere from 10 to 50% of the fish oil, depending on how the product's made. And so you're trying to get your DHA levels specifically up, and the more the better, especially for factors like metabolism and cardiovascular inflammation, cognitive health, and this study certainly supports that. All right, lutein and zeaxanthin for brain and eyes. So research going on at the USDA, Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging, Tufts University, it's the Department of Agriculture, they're touting the carotenes lutein and zeaxanthin. Zeaxanthin is kind of in the beta-carotene family. In other words, a lot of supplements or sources of beta-carotene naturally occurring might have some zeaxanthin in them. And lutein, of course, is highly concentrated in spinach. But lutein and zeaxanthin will cross over into the structure of the eye, the retina of the eye. It's kind of like the blood-brain barrier, but it's the retinal barrier. They actually can go in there. So they have this ability to get into places. And one of the places they do get into better than a lot of other carotenes is the brain. And the researchers here are pointing out that the analysis of brain tissues from deceased people, in this case, and it was a study of centenarians, the people that lived to be 100, and they had all kinds of, tests prior to their passing on their cognitive function, their memory, their verbal skills, lack of dementia, all that kind of stuff. And they found that the zeaxanthin concentrations were significantly related to better function when they were alive. And lutein was related to better recall and verbal fluency. So we see here that in that retrospective type of a study, that was good. There was also a 4-month double-blind placebo-controlled trial conducted in older women that showed that lutein supplementation of 12 milligrams a day or in combination with DHA at 800 milligrams a day found that verbal fluency scores improved significantly in both DHA and lutein and when they were combined. So these carotenes do get into the brain. They do work synergistically with DHA to boost brain function. And this is now something, a lot of times we think of, just carotenes. I mean, the big thing for lutein and zeaxanthin is they accumulate in the retinal pigment of your eye, thus preventing macular degeneration, which, of course, is very important for anyone who's getting older. And you have, carotenes either slowly accumulate by being in your blood, and they slowly accumulate in tissues, such as the macular pigment of the eye, but also elsewhere, including the brain, or they slowly decline. And as they decline, health goes with them. So it's a fairly straightforward proposition of basic supplementation for health. Have some carotenes, mixed variety, lycopene, lutein, zeaxanthin, beta-carotene. There are others. And these things are good to have in your diet and in your supplements so that you have blood levels of them that are in your body and thus can accumulate. We know, for example, that 20 milligram lutein intake per day will accumulate in the macular pigment of the eye. And you can predict macular pigment levels are known to reflect brain levels, which is kind of interesting. So that's some other research in this regard. Anyway, the USDA, very interested in this topic, out promoting it and letting everybody know that lutein and zeaxanthin are not only good for your eyes, but also good for your brain. So another benefit of your basic antioxidant nutrient support. So you've got your B vitamins, your calcium, your magnesium, your DHA, your antioxidants of different kinds, your chemical protective antioxidants like Silymarin. I mean, these are just kind of basic things that people need. I mean, we didn't need to use Silymarin until we got so polluted in the environment, but now it's kind of like a daily supplement as far as I'm concerned, because you need these kind of things to protect yourself just from the environment in which we live, which for anyone in any major big city is polluted, and that's just a fact of life. So, your body has to be on guard for that, and your basic antioxidant function is extremely important in that regard. All right, let's go to your questions this week. First one comes from John. It says, what are the main reasons the person would not want to get a flu vaccine? How effective are they really? Well, John, there are actually a lot of reasons a person would not want to get a flu vaccine. They're typically grown in eggs, so they're attached to myelin protein. And the myelin protein that they're attached to then attracts them into your nervous system. So vaccines have this preponderance of entering into your nerves. And then, of course, if mercury, as thimerosal, which is typically used in flu vaccines, is part of it, then that can be attracted into your nervous system. And mercury, of course, is not good for you in your nerves. So that would be one reason that a person wouldn't really want to do the vaccine. Vaccines are like crying wolf, especially the flu vaccine. And so you end up, after it's over, maybe you get some protection, depending on how close a match the actual viral antigens are that are in there. But you end up with immune cells that are they think they went to battle and they didn't. So you actually end up with a lot of immune cells that basically like to sit around the table and tell old war stories and really aren't very good at doing anything. And if you do this year after year, you got a whole platoon of storytellers and not very many guys that want to go into actual battle. And so one of the things about vaccines that's hardly ever talked about is that you actually condition the more of them you do, you actually condition your immune system to be incompetent as you grow older, which of course is a problem with aging anyway. So that's another issue. There are typically boosters in vaccines called adjuvants because they're using attenuated or deadened viruses. And so, you know, why would your immune system react to that? So they usually put some irritant in there called an adjuvant. And the adjuvant cross-reacts with the mercury and the myelin chicken protein to basically create an inflammatory state in your nerves. And, of course, your ability to tolerate that depends on your underlying health. I think it's quite dangerous in small children because their brains are rapidly evolving. Why would you want to throw an inflammatory cocktail into their nervous system and hope for the best? I mean, it's kind of reckless. I know that the herd mentality of the public health officials like their vaccines, but, you know, in reality, the people who really don't need them are the ones who would most likely get the best response from them, ironically, because their immune systems are more likely to behave in the textbook fashion that's desired to a vaccine, whereas people who are older, for example, get very little benefit from them. In fact, there was some University of Minnesota research out last year where one of the main immunologists, very well known, well respected, did an analysis on all of the flu vaccines and found that for age 65 and older, there's basically no benefit to the flu vaccine, and which is like the population that you know you're trying to protect because their immune system is already inefficient. So basically, the more inefficient the immune system, the more likely you are to have bad reactions and the more likely it is not to work anyway. So I mean, it's a tough sell. So they're not that effective. There's no data to show they're effective. A lot of times they don't even match the current strains that end up coming around. So they might have a little bit of similarity, giving you a little bit of protection, maybe. But as I say here, the older you are or the worse health you're in, which would generally mean that you might consider one of these things, the least likely you are to benefit from it. So, you know, it's nothing I've ever done, John. I've never had a flu vaccine, never will. Don't bother. Anyway, Ellen says, I've read that vitamin D is important for fighting the flu. Is that true and how does it work? Well, vitamin D activates a receptor called VDR, the vitamin D receptor, which is really a gene regulator. And so vitamin D, more than being a vitamin, it's a direct regulator of the human genome, your genetics. Of course, we're familiar with that in the context of calcium and bone building. And that's working because vitamin D is activating gene signals that orchestrate the bone building process. But it does a lot more than that, and it's especially involved with immunity. So one of the keys of vitamin D is it is involved with immune system tolerance. And what that means is that the immune system, when it's going into battle, it heats up. It fires a lot of free radical bullets at the enemy. It's kind of like shootout at the OK Corral. You know, you've got the germs firing at you and you firing back, and it gets hot. So the question becomes, how hot can the frying pan get from the heat of the battle before the whole system melts down? And it is vitamin D specifically, the VDR activity, that regulates the heat of battle, preventing it from overheating, meaning that you can tolerate more firefights without having a frying pan that, you know, catches fire, literally, and burns the whole house down, you might say. So if you are in an immune system battle and you are vitamin D deficient, you are much more likely to overheat, have out-of-control, inflammatory, inappropriate immune system reactions that lead to sepsis and extreme toxicity that would then potentially be deadly in the case of a viral infection that was serious, whereas vitamin D would give you a lot better immune system functionality. Another very interesting theory that's gaining quite a bit of momentum is that vitamin D adequacy is critical also to just general immune health, to the point that people who are adequate in vitamin D do not harbor infections. And this is leading to the theory that instead of the flu vaccine being of any use, what would be much more useful would be vitamin D adequacy amongst the well population. So this is kind of interesting because we normally think of viruses spreading from sick people to sick people, which does in fact happen. But what this data is indicating is that well people can carry the virus and then pass it on to a sick person if the well person is lacking in vitamin D. So they're low in vitamin D, not sick, and they're a friendly petri dish to pass along the infection to somebody else who then does get sick for whatever reason. The point being, and it's very good science, that vitamin D adequacy would probably be the best strategy possible for a public health policy to prevent severity and spreading of flu. And I would be willing to bet it would be far more effective, especially in older people, where it's known to help them and where flu vaccines are not. So I think if we made a concerted effort to get those at risk vitamin D adequate, we'd have a lot less problems. Susan says, my mother has been sick recently, and just when it seems she's getting better, she gets sick again with seemingly the same illness. She also seems to be in a mental fog where her memory is worse. Is that possible? Well, we have to be quite careful to actually get over illnesses fully. I think the bugs that have been around in the last 10 years and certainly the last few years are stronger and stronger. I've noticed this trend because, of course, I work on the front lines of clinical nutrition, helping people who come down with this, that, and the other. And there has been a trend, especially in the last decade, where the intensity and the lingering effect of germs is much more pronounced than it has been in the past. So for whatever reason, we seem to be breeding superbugs or more intense infections quite readily. Now, one of the ways of addressing this issue and thinking about this issue is to realize that after an illness is over, the battlefield, as I was referring to earlier, is in a tattered condition. You know, it's kind of like a storm blowing through, and then what's left after the storm is all the potential damage to the terrain. And in this case, the storm being the infection, it leaves a lot of inflamed and tattered tissues that are not in great shape for a while. And actually, in order to get well, not only do you need to get on top of the infection, but you simultaneously need to clear out the inflamed tissue damage. So for that, I would recommend a product like Repair Plus, which has the bromelain and the curcumin that help to clean up things. Grapeseed extract is very good. Resveratrol is very good. Quercetin is very good. You need nutrients that help the house cleaning process clear up the tissue that's inflamed so that it's stronger, because the debris on the battlefield makes the tissue weaker. Now it's a friendlier place for germs to reactivate, some of which are probably still lingering, but also the inflammatory particles confuse the immune system so that if the germ does start to reactivate, then it's a compromised response. And normally, of course, if a person gets sick, they were kind of compromised for one reason or another in the first place. So part of getting over a bug isn't just feeling better that first day. It's actually a couple, two or three days of more concentrated house cleaning and repair of inflammation, and then gradually doing more to the point that you can sustain your actual normal energy level properly. And if you can't do that, your house cleaning activities are not up to snuff. And you can tell this because you just can't get through the day with the same level of energy. And therefore, you need to work on anti-inflammation tissue repair as a priority to fully recover from the bug so that you're not more susceptible to the next one. Now, the second part of your question here about mental fog and memory, this is a big deal. And what happens is the toxicity of the infections, especially Well, there's a various numbers of different toxic compounds that these infections produce, but they can get through the blood-brain barrier and they can damage and injure brain function. And for a younger person, that's recoverable a lot more easily than it is for an older person, to the point where individuals, say, for example, who already have significant problems like some level of dementia or some degree of Alzheimer, when they get sick, those toxins knock their mental function down a whole nother notch or degree, and it's not really very easy to recover in that particular patient population. So another strategy would certainly be to protect the brain from toxins. So something like Daily Balancer that helps to clear the toxins, both the Silymarin and the R-alpha lipoic acid are very good brain antioxidants anyway. But any kind of brain support that, Super Brain Booster, Brain Protector, there's a lot of help there. Phosphatidylserine, DHA, acetyl-L-carnitine. I mean, there's a long list here. But you want to, especially as part of the healing process, if there has been any knockdown in memory or cognitive clarity or anything after an infection, you also want to work on getting that back as quickly as possible as part of the recovery from the inflammation. And of course, this would be, unfortunately, this isn't a more significant problem in somebody who is older, because they'd be less capable in general of recovering as well or as quickly. Not that they can't, but they have to be more aware of this issue and take steps. Jan says, I have every symptom of really tired adrenals, having been worn down from years of stress. I did a saliva test for cortisol, and it says my cortisol levels are high all day. Does this mean I actually have hyperadrenals? I'm confused. Well, Jan, as you probably know, your cortisol goes in a 24-hour pattern. It's one of its rhythms. And so it's highest in the morning. That helps your body utilize calories, actually sugar, as well as kind of wakes your body up, sets the stage for action. Because, the primary function of cortisol, besides helping with calorie metabolism, is actually like oil in a car engine. So your adrenals are basically providing lubrication so your body can go faster. So, when you have tired adrenals, you're run down, you feel kind of burned out, trouble getting going in the morning, might get dizzy when you stand up, lack of stress tolerance, all of these things, those are indicative of an adrenal system that cannot keep up with the demands. So then you enter into the saliva testing world. And they're going to try to, take like four of these measurements through the day to see what your levels are doing. And in your case, you were probably expecting them to come back low, which generally means that your adrenals can't make enough cortisol to keep up. Instead, yours came back high. And so does that mean you have hyperadrenals? Well, not in the sense of like hyper and hypothyroid. It doesn't mean something like that, Jan. It means that your adrenals are working overtime trying to make oil because your body is just too hot from being worn down. So cortisol is one anti-inflammatory system that your body is over-relying on. If it's high all day, that tends to mean that your body now has lost its cortisol rhythm, which is actually a problem because now it doesn't go up and down in any kind of form. It's just kind of stuck and it's lost its rhythmicity. So this means that you really have to boost up anti-inflammatory nutrition. I'd maximize your DHA up to about 2,000 milligrams of DHA per day. I would use nutrients like Repair Plus, Bone and Joint Helper. I'd use adrenal support, the B vitamins, vitamin C, Stress Helper. I mean, you've got to hit it from the nourishment of the adrenals plus other tools that help you to manage inflammation, so that you can get your cortisol back on track, because without that, then you don't really have much in the way of rhythms. I mean, I'm sure if somebody asked you, Jan, if you feel in sync, you'd say, no, I don't. Your energy is most likely inconsistent, and when it comes on, it goes off, and, it's not real good. So you've got to really reduce the inflammations to take the stress off of your adrenals having to do too much. Ed says, my 5-year-old son holds his bowel movements to the point of constipation and seems very anxious when it is time to go. Are there any tips to get him over this problem? Well, normally, your son has some imbalance of candida or bacteria that are creating some odd feelings and sensations in there. The increased inflammation of that, in other words, there's something called the vagus nerve that feeds back a lot of nerve-related connections into the brain stem. And if it's starting to heat up in there from inflammation in the gut, then that provokes the feeling of anxiety and creates this tension. Now, the bowel motility, the natural bowel motility, does not run on the anxious side of the nervous system. It actually runs on the relaxed side of the nervous system. Thus, this sort of scenario tends to generate a lack of rhythm of the bowels moving forward. And this causes the problem. So in a 5-year-old, I like GI Soother at pretty high doses, a tablespoon rounded, maybe up to 3 or 4 times a day, some acidophilus. You might be able to get by with less, GI Soother, maybe a teaspoon, even once a day might do the job. But you want to try to clear out the bugs in there. And then get him calm in general. Have him do more hobbies, have him do more activities, a little more aerobic-like exercise, which all helps to calm the nerves. Maybe a little more magnesium intake would be another good thing that could be done, because he needs to learn the pattern of rhythm. So once we get the nerves under control, because the inflammation isn't being generated from within the digestive tract, there should be less anxiousness. But see, now he's kind of learned a habit of anxiousness relating to bowels, and that throws him off into the wrong synchronization. So you might have to expand relaxing activities to also help. And then once he starts to get in the rhythm of this, then it will the pattern will take hold after about a month. But even once the germ problem is under control in the gut, it still takes about a month to train the pattern to be more normal. But at least, you know, the problem that's punching the nerves in the nose and causing this anxious tension lockup is been corrected. Now he just has to learn the pattern better, because he's still young and he still doesn't have necessarily the full control of that rhythm yet. And he needs to learn that as a lesson so that his bowels move the right direction. And it's a good habit for life. Sue says, I have white spots all over my fingernails, which just started showing up a few years ago after a bad infection. I've never felt quite as good since then, but what do the white spots mean? Well, generally, white spots on the fingernails mean that the protein metabolism in your body is being disturbed. So the fingernails are a record of growth, you might say. They're a fairly fast-growing tissue. And they require, I like to say that nail growth is reflective of bone growth, because a lot of the same factors are involved. Nail strength is also important. But the white spots indicate basically discrepancies. You know, it's kind of interesting. A lot of times if you have, you know, a bad infection, and this probably was the case when you had your bad infection a few years ago, if you would have looked at your nails, you would have had a horizontal ridge across them, which indicates the trauma of protein metabolism that was going on during that infection. Anyway, that's probably grown out now, and unless you had another trauma, you wouldn't have that horizontal ridge. But the ability to assemble proteins shows up in your fingernails and is predictive of what's going on in your body. So when you see this happening, several years following an infection, a couple things come to mind. One, well, of course, the white spots generally mean a deficiency of zinc, which would, of course, be required to fight an infection. So quite possibly the infection you fought lowered your zinc level, or you still have subclinically active infection that's further causing problems with zinc. And the other thing I find that really helps white spots is MSM sulfur. So that's why I actually developed the product Sulfur Plus, Strengthener Plus, which has zinc and sulfur in it, was actually originally, believe it or not, to help people with white spots on their nails, because I found out that both of them were helpful. And so sometimes just taking zinc and sulfur will clear them up. And if it doesn't, then I would also boost up other immune support because you may still have a low-grade little something there that's bothering you. But usually, you know, 50 to 75 milligrams of zinc for a while will clear them up. And then once they're better, you can back that down and see how it holds. All right, that's it for your questions this week. If you have a question for me, please email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. Have a great week, and of course I will be back next week with yet another Weekly Wellness Update podcast. Take care.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated, copyright 2008, all rights reserved. For more information on the topics and views covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.